May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Cuke Audio Podcast. I'm D.C. Puba of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his, and anything else that comes to mind. Today, I'm going to read something that was cut from Crooked Cucumber, the second piece that was cut. I only have two cut pieces that I've preserved. I really hated to cut this. I don't know why. I guess they give me a page limit. And, the story moved along without it. But I hated to cut out Elsie Mitchell. So I'm gonna read that. And then I'm going to read you some from an article I wrote on Elsie Mitchell. She has a rather extensive section on Cuke.com. Let's just see. I don't think I have to give her much introduction because I think what I'm going to read is going to do that. So, after the pause to meditate, we're going to go right into that. Now, that bell that opened up this podcast and that will finish it up, that's from AAG Monastery, a recording that Elsie and her husband John made in 1959. And it's part of the set of The Way of Aheji. It was on Folkways Records, a two-album set. The whole thing is on Cuke.com. Chanting, the monks chanting the Heart Sutra and all sorts of stuff. It's really great. They did a really high-quality job. So when you hear the bell, if you feel like it, hit pause. And then meditate or whatever, for as long as you wish. And when you're ready to come back, hit unpause. And then we'll hit the bell and just be waiting for you. And you will have meditated with everyone who ever meditated during that pause. And actually at another level, with everyone who ever meditated. And at another level, with everyone, regardless. A visit to Massachusetts. Whenever I receive your letters, and even when I read them later, I find great encouragement in them. Now I have decided to visit your home one of these days after the 20th of this month. Please let me know what day is convenient for you and where and how I can meet you. I think I can stay there more than 1 week. I have no idea of forcing our way on anyone, but I want to be sincere enough to accept people and help people improving for the better. I am sure we will have interesting talks between us about the matters that concern us most. With Gassho, Reverend Shunryu Suzuki. I am always in black robe with Japanese kimono. Letter of September 9th, 1964 to Elsie Mitchell. Elsie Mitchell had enlisted the help of a few members of her Cambridge Buddhist Association in order to prepare for Reverend Suzuki, who was scheduled to fly in the following evening. They were cleaning up the library come meditation hall, his bedroom, the kitchen, the living room. On a table in the entryway, there was a recently received card from the soon-to-be-honored guest giving his time of arrival, flight number, and revealing his inmost tinglings. Since I bought the ticket, I have started to feel excited. I can hardly imagine how I'll feel when I meet you at the Boston airport at the other end of this continent. This would be their third meeting. Elsie had visited Sokoji in 1959 and again in 1963, both times when she was on her way back home after visiting Eiheiji and her teacher Fujimoto in Japan. There were not many Buddhist groups in the United States at that time that catered to Caucasians, and just a few small Zen groups, the oldest being the First Zen Institute of America in New York City. The Cambridge Buddhist Association wasn't a temple and didn't have a priest. Professor Hisamatsu led the Zazen, but it was a friendly Buddhist group with a Zendo, and Elsie had the Soto ties in Japan. The main glue was that he and Elsie had made a personal connection. He appreciated the non-fanatical, mature way she committed herself to Buddhism and to helping to establish it in America, step by step, and without making a big deal of herself. She admired his low-key, open-minded style, the fact that he had worked so hard on his English, and how well he had adapted to American life. He was less culture-bound than other Japanese priests she had known. She had been greatly impressed with his integrity, his goodness, and particularly his willingness to work out ways of traditional Buddhist practice really suitable for contemporary Westerners. Her favorite story to tell about Suzuki was what happened next on the evening she and others were preparing for his arrival. Everyone was wet with sweat, or mop water in old work clothes, feeling rather dirty and unpresentable when the doorbell rang. Elsie's husband, John, stopped his dusting, stepped down from the ladder, opened the door, and who should be standing there with traveling bag and grin as a taxi behind him sped away but the Reverend Shunryu Suzuki. They had been so sure he was coming the next evening, and they were absolutely nonplussed by his arrival. "Oh, we didn't think you were coming till tomorrow," said Elsie. He'd obviously written the wrong date on the card. Suzuki told her, He'd obviously, Suzuki told her and laughed unashamedly and most amused at the situation. Well, let me help you for the important day of my arrival, he said, tying his kimono sleeves up behind his neck. Everyone protested, no, 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 you can't work, and bid him to rest after his trip. But, of course, there was nothing he would rather have done than to join in with them in cleaning. And they cleaned and cleaned until it was late and past bedtime. Suzuki, completely at home, in his new surroundings, and everyone charmed as could be. The next morning after Zazen and breakfast, Elsie told Suzuki to take it easy for a while, that she had to go out and do some shopping. When she got back with her groceries, she found him outside on a tall ladder cleaning windows in his white long underwear in plain view of her most proper neighbors. The Mitchells took him to their country place at Cape Cod and let him be alone whenever he wanted. He sat Zazen in the morning on a large rock on the beach, chanted with the waves, and walked back to the house as the sun came up. He called that his secret hobby and said his wife wouldn't have let him do that because it was too cold and wet. He weeded around the house, adjusted a few stones in the rock garden, raked leaves, and trimmed their bushes. There were boulder-sized stones in the garden, and Suzuki worried his hosts the way he'd climb on the big stones and jump from one to another. He made a miniature garden of moss, berries, and sand in a large shell so he could take a bit of New England back to California with me. John put it sideways into a wide-mouthed jar to protect it. They talked about Buddhism and Christianity in Japan and America, about Fujimoto Roshi and Fujimoto's Dharma brother in polar opposite the spirited Yasutani Roshi, who used koans and was conducting so many sesshin for lay people, including Westerners in Japan. Walking around outdoors, Suzuki got down on the ground for a close look at what little bugs and rocks and plants were there, and then he rolled over and peered up at the trees. He was almost giddy. Elsie had to keep pulling him back from wandering into poison ivy. He took some of it and planted it in his garden in a jar. He kept remarking at the beautiful colors of the fall leaves on the deciduous trees. Not much of that near San Francisco. There were seasons here. So much reminded him of Japan, especially the pines. And parts of old Boston were like areas of Tokyo. He felt quite at home and said he'd be back as soon as he could. Elsie said, the nice thing about Suzuki Roshi was I never thought about him in terms of practice. He was a supremely likable, wonderful example of the human race and had a simplicity and a friendliness and a wonderful sense of humor, and one felt terribly comfortable with him. There was nothing pretentious about him. I know he talked about practice and lectures, but with me he never talked about his practice or anyone's practice. He was just very natural and easygoing. That same month, Elsie received another card from Suzuki. Tuesday, September 29th, 1964. Dear Mr. Mrs. Mitchell, I have just come back without the beautiful but poison oak-like plant and my Japanese coat. I told my wife all the rest of the things which I did at your home, except my secret hobby. Will you please keep my goat till I visit you next time? With Gassho, Reverend S. Suzuki. Elsie sent his coat back in a wooden box with a donation for the Zen Center, which Suzuki set aside for his next trip to Boston. So that's that piece. Too bad that was cut. Well, you know, in the second edition and in the audiobook, we can include it. I'm going to comment on a few things in here. So typical, of him to arrive. Written the wrong date. God. It says it was probably the only group outside of his own in Japan town that Suzuki had ever joined in America. I think I should just cut that. That's got too many holes in it. I mean, he went up to read and sat with those people. You know, he went to Seattle once. I just don't have anything on that. I can't even remember anything. I don't have anything written or anything, but I know he went to Seattle once. There's just nothing on it. Some names are coming to mind, but anyway, it's just one of those little dark corridors where I didn't turn on the lights. And I didn't find any way to do it. Or maybe I could have. You know, the thing is, I could have a long time ago. But when I first started working on Crooked Cucumber 25 years ago, I'm sure I could have figured something out. But anyway, no matter. Oh, that's when it says that she had been greatly impressed with his integrity, his goodness, and particularly his willingness to work out ways of traditional Buddhist practice suitable for contemporary Westerners. That's all in quotes. That's all straight out of my interview with her. I talked to her on the phone now and then. We kept up. We continued talking. She got dementia toward the end. And, you know, it got harder and harder to relate to her. And then, you know, I wasn't in touch with, I had met other people in the family, but, you know, I wasn't in touch with them enough to have been informed when she died. She had told me to meet her brother, Ned Johnson, who was CEO of Fidelity. Her father sort of founded Fidelity, but actually, Fidelity already existed or something. He took it over, but he made it what it was. I mean, it wasn't anything like what he made it. Like what? The biggest mutual fund in the world? And so her brother's Ned Johnson. Her father was Ed Johnson. Suzuki's original contact there with Richard Baker was with Ed Johnson. And Ed Johnson just loved Suzuki. He made very substantial contributions to Zen Center toward the purchase of Tassajara and I think toward Page Street and Green Gulch. And I'm not sure what. I should ask Baker about that. And also, Ed Johnson really liked Richard Baker. In fact, Baker went over there while he was living in Japan. All of a sudden, he showed up at Zen Center one day. Everybody was surprised. They knew, what? We thought you were, what are you doing back here? And he went, like, to Boston for, like, a month or something at Ed Johnson's request just to live in, the Boston's main club or the Fidelity Club or something like that and just hang out with them. And he decided to do it because, you know, he wanted to, you know, see if he could have some influence on, you know, anti-war stuff and humanizing investment or whatever. I remember talking to him about that. But, Suzuki just shook his head. He didn't know what the heck was happening there. And Baker has continued his relationship with Ned Johnson. And, you know, he was close with Elsie, too. She said he'd arrive in town and take her car and use it to get around. Zintatsu Baker Roshi. I just had an exchange with him today. He wanted to find some Windbell article. And he just asked, are the Windbell articles on the fires in the 70s on your site? I said, yes. All the Windbells are there. And there's a page. And I showed him. Whenever somebody asks, I don't just like to answer their question. I like to show them how they could have found it very easily. Like, go to the site, write Windbell, go to the main Windbell page or whatever comes up. And then there's links, right? And there's a search page. And you just write fire in the keyword. And then, like, three or four articles fire in Windbells in the 70s came up with links. Bang, hit it, go to it. He took the poison ivy, put it in a jar. You know, the thing about, but poison ivy probably wasn't any danger to him. I grew up around poison ivy. And, I just couldn't get it. I would, you know, once to show off to friends that I couldn't get it, I took some and rubbed it on my face. And I got a little bit. But I learned more about this sort of thing later. And that was a very foolish thing to do. And I'll tell you why. Because at Tassajara, what we would tell guests is that public enemy number one is poison oak. And poison oak, the thing about it is, now some people arrive there and have a terrible allergy to it just right away. There were people who got it from there, I swear. And they get it from dogs. They go, oh, God, I've seen. And not just with the leaves. Steve Brown, once we were digging in a hole, digging a trench or something. I think it was out by the gatehouse in front. And, you know, he was just pulling up some roots that were in there. Well, it turned out that was poison oak. And he had to be taken to the hospital the next day. There were no leaves. So he had a bad allergy. I think mainly the allergy comes from being in contact with it. And that's why we would tell people, and I especially would tell people, and, you know, one problem we've got at Zen Center and at Tassajara is lack of continuity. So, you know, like when I was director, I would, you know, left extensive notes all organized and everything for the next director. You know, he didn't pay any attention to them, and et cetera, like that. But one of the things is that you don't want to be in touch with poison oak, and it's all over around there. You really got to be careful. Because, yeah, you might not get it today because you don't have an allergy, but you get an allergy by being in touch with it. So you don't want to do a stupid thing like I did with poison ivy in Texas. Although I never did get a bad case. And I get poison oak some. You know what I learned to do is rub, we have this basic H liquid soap, like organic soap that I'd arranged. I'd become a salesman for Basic Age and I would get a 55-gallon drum of it, like at a wholesale price. I had one customer in Tassajara, and just, you know, before working around Poison Oak, which I would do almost entirely, that would happen when I was working on the phone line. I would cover myself with it. You know, take off my shirt, put it everywhere, and cover myself with it, and go right into a poison oak bush. You know, that the phone line went through and there was a connector there and it had to all be trimmed. And I'd come straight out of there, take off all my clothes, go into the creek. Thank God that was near the creek. And wash it all off with cold water. You don't want to wash it off with hot water because that opens your pores, right? And then I'd wash my clothes. And it would be in the hot summer. So I'd put back my wet clothes back on and they just dry on me. And then when I got back to Tassajara, I'd go to the baths and wash off with Fels Naphtha, I think kerosene-based laundry soap. And that's what we had for poison oak there, which is usually, like if I went for a hike, I'd come back and wash with Fels Naphtha. But I might, if I was on a hike, throw some of that stuff on me. But usually I save that sort of extreme protection for if I was actually going to be working in it. So, well, that's a rather extensive comment on the poison ivy there. And you know, at the end where he says, I told my wife all the rest of the things which I did at your home. And then he had underlined, except my secret hobby. What he was talking about there was going down to the beach and sitting on the rock and doing zazen, you know, like while, for the sunrise. And, see, he's just an old hippie at heart there. God, yeah. Elsie's... the article on Elsie I have on Goop.com is 14 pages. I mean, good Lord. Of course, you know, online there aren't pages. But I downloaded it here. Oh, my God. You know what? I'm going to put that up next week. I think this has gone on long enough. And I got to get out and do some other stuff. And I got to go over this whole thing and get it uploaded. So, this has been a Kook Audio Podcast. I'm DC Poobah of Kook Audio and Kook Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sonor with Doggett Bandita, Feline Cuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And we're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.